The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
As the 1950s were coming to an end, so was the illusion that Fort Worth, Texas, was a place immune to the type of violent crime that was so prevalent in the big city 25 miles to its east, Dallas. Ready to welcome a new and prosperous decade, Fort Worth had certainly grown into a new town, and with industries like steel and oil setting up shop there in the previous couple decades, the city was no longer the place that metropolitan Dallasites once snubbed their noses at for being too sleepy. The city that a Dallas lawyer said, in 1875, was so slow and uneventful, he saw a panther asleep on the steps in front of the courthouse. Now, this lawyer, Robert E. Cowart, wasn't actually from Dallas. He'd moved there from that boring town he sought to insult with the sleeping panther bit. But Cowart was at least somewhat right. At the time, cattle trading was Fort Worth's biggest economic driver, and even that industry had taken a big hit following a brutal winter in 1873. That terrible winter also laid waste to much of the city's brothels, gambling dens, and saloons in the Fort Worth's Bloody Third Ward, or Hell's Half Acre. For at least a few year span, the debauchery and lawlessness of Hell's Half Acre rivaled that of the infamous town of Deadwood, South Dakota. But Fort Worth, obviously, wasn't as prepared for a hard winter as those folks were up there. This was at least part of the point Cowart sought to make with his snarky remark. As a lawyer, there just wasn't much action for him in Fort Worth anymore. Not like there was in Dallas, anyway. But that's the way Fort Worth residents liked it. Life in the city was slow, and the folks easygoing and friendly. Major and violent crime certainly existed in Fort Worth, but a lot of outlaw-type activity was thought of as kind of par for the course in Cowtown. And anyway, Fort Worth's criminal activity didn't hold a candle to Dallas when it came to the sheer senselessness and brutality of the acts. That was big city stuff. By the mid-20th century, though, no matter how hard residents attempted to will it away, Fort Worth had become a big city. And as is always the case, the violent crime rate rose right alongside the population. In the first several days of June of 1959, Fort Worth Star-Telegram front page news headlines concerning local happenings reflected the city's reluctance to transition into the big city it had been growing into since the early 40s. A rabies scare throughout Fort Worth and Arlington seemed to be big local news. Apparently, rabid skunks were a problem in the area. The city's crime rate had risen, sure, but the extreme violence, the sexually motivated and savage murders that blasted the front page headlines of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in the 1970s, 1980s, and into the 1990s were still a ways off. A machinist strike at a Fort Worth steel and machinery company in the summer of 1959 had resulted in some violence. And scattered stories of crimes like robbery and teenage grand theft auto graced the front page of the Star-Telegram, but usually nothing crazy. Nothing that would send chills down the spines of readers of the newspaper, enough to have them double-checking the locks on their doors and clenching their loaded shotgun or rifle as they slept. Nothing, that is, until the evening edition of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram hit the stands on June 10th, 1959. The large, bold black letters of the front page headline of the newspaper read, "Oakhurst couple found beaten to death in home." In 1959, Fort Worth residents Hattie and Vernon Stanley lived on Bluebonnet Drive in the city's Oakhurst neighborhood. The couple had done well with their lives, but they'd certainly seen their share of hardships. likely more hardships than we'll ever know, as details about Hattie and Vernon's life are scarce. Vernon Stanley was born in Cleburne, Texas, Johnson County, on August 2, 1892, to parents William and Lizzie. He enlisted in the United States Army as a young man, barely out of adolescence, and served as a major in World War I. Shortly after completing his service and coming back to Texas, Stanley married his sweetheart, Hattie. Hattie was born Hattie Leona Putnam to parents James and Martha on April 17, 1894, in Mississippi. When she and 27-year-old Vernon were married, they settled down in Fort Worth and began their family shortly thereafter when 25-year-old Hattie gave birth to twin boys on March 23, 1920, Vernon Jr. and Virgil. The family began attending Sunday services at North Fort Worth Baptist Church, where Vernon and Hattie would remain members until they died. Having served in the war, Vernon Stanley Sr. was likely no stranger to loss. But when one of he and Hattie's twin boys and the man's namesake, Vernon Jr., died of Crohn's disease on May 31, 1923, at only 3 years old, loss and grief hit the young family in an unimaginable way. Nearly 2 years later, when Hattie gave birth to a baby girl prematurely on January 30, 1925, and the infant died the following day, more grief befell the Stanleys. 7 years after that, on October 10, 1932, though, Hattie Stanley gave birth to another boy, and the couple named him Shirley Bob Stanley, who was most often called Bobby. The Stanley family, other than their incredible losses, lived and enjoyed normal and happy lives in Fort Worth. Both Virgil and Bobby made their folks proud and became officers in the military. Bobby in the Air Force, and Virgil, like his old man, a major in the Army. Virgil also served in World War II. When Bobby left to join the military, Hattie and Vernon, in 1949, bought a home on the 1800 block of Bluebonnet Drive in Fort Worth's Oakhurst neighborhood, just north of downtown. It was a nice place for the couple, a step up. The 7-room red Austin stone home on Bluebonnet included 2 bathrooms and was described as modern, a house for those who could afford the finest. Now, the home wasn't a mansion by any stretch, but it was a nice middle-class home in a newer neighborhood that was covered in large live oaks and pecan trees that provided the roads and houses with ample shade from the unrelenting Texas sun. The Stanleys' new home was on a large lot, landscaped beautifully and far enough away from the neighbors that enjoying the outdoors in privacy wasn't a problem. At some point, Hattie and Vernon began breeding party-colored Cocker Spaniels, advertised in the papers as Champion Sired and AKC, or American Kennel Club, certified. The couple did pretty good for themselves and seemed to be happy. Presumably, Vernon's used car lot on North Main in Fort Worth was a success, a business he handed over to his son Virgil to run when he decided to retire sometime in the 1950s. By 1959, Virgil had learned his old man's business and was running things at the car lot just fine, and Vernon and Hattie's other son, Bobby, was in the Air Force, stationed in Newfoundland. For a little extra money, and because they had the space available, the couple rented out the 3-room apartment above the detached garage of their home for $65 a month. The last ad that ran looking for a tenant was on March 6, 1959. A little over 3 months after that ad saw print, Vernon and Hattie Stanley were brutally murdered in their home. On Sunday, June 7, 1959, Virgil Stanley and his wife dropped by his parents' Oakhurst home for an afternoon visit. 39-year-old Virgil spoke with his parents often. He or his wife called them every morning, in fact, because both had a history of heart problems. His mother, Hattie, had just turned 65 years old, and Vernon, his father, was about to turn 67. Anyway, the visit was a normal one, and nothing out of the ordinary occurred. The following day, Virgil's wife phoned Hattie and Vernon and spoke with them briefly. On Tuesday, Virgil's wife went out of town, and in a casual phone conversation that evening, Virgil mentioned to her that his father didn't come down to the car lot that day. Vernon Stanley was retired but still came by the used car lot nearly every day. However, he and Hattie were having a new roof put on their bluebonnet drive home that day, so Virgil just figured his dad was too busy to make an appearance. Later, at 7 p.m., a neighbor of the couple spoke with Vernon, who told him that he'd had some men service their air conditioner earlier in the day. It was working well, Vernon told his neighbor. The guys did a good job. The next morning, on Wednesday, June 10, 1959, both Virgil and his wife attempted to call Hattie and Vernon several times to check up on them, but there was a busy signal every time. Virgil headed to the car lot to open up, while his wife phoned Vernon and Hattie's doctor to see if perhaps they had any appointments that day. Meanwhile, not long after making it to work, a friend of the Stanleys phoned Virgil at the car lot and asked if he'd seen his mother. Hattie was supposed to pick her friend up, but she never showed. It wasn't like her. Something, Virgil thought to himself, wasn't right. He'd better head over there. When he arrived, the doors to the house were locked. Virgil didn't have a key, so he approached the tenants who lived in the above garage apartment on the property to see if they had one, but they did not. Somehow, it was never made clear exactly how, Virgil got into his parents' home. He stepped into what looked like the scene of a burglary, but it got worse. It was, in fact, a nightmare. After making his way through the ransacked home, the overturned furniture, the scattered belongings covering the floor, he made it to his parents' bedroom. The sight before him there was terrible and bloody. It was unimaginable. Just inside the door laid Virgil's mother, Hattie Stanley. She'd been bludgeoned to death with a blunt object in the home's hallway, dragged into the bedroom, and a small rug from the hallway was placed over her upper body, the larger bedroom rug, over her legs and feet. She was dressed in her nightgown. 65-year-old Hattie was struck with a heavy object 3 times in the head, an autopsy later showed. On the bed laid Vernon's bloodied body. The mattress was partially on top of him, and his legs dangled off, his feet on the floor. He, too, was brutally beaten to death with a blunt instrument. He was wearing only boxer shorts. At autopsy, it was determined that 66-year-old Vernon was struck a total of 7 times in the head. Both Hattie and Vernon's cause of death were listed as fractured skulls. Reports in the newspaper described the injuries a bit more gratuitously, calling both their heads caved in. Upon the discovery of his parents, Virgil fell to his knees, sobbing. After finally speaking with Vernon and Hattie's doctor, Virgil's wife had discovered that they did not have any scheduled appointments, so she thought she'd call their house one last time. She dialed the number. After a couple rings, Virgil answered.
"Something's wrong," Virgil told her. "Don't come out here. I've got to call the police now."
At 11 a.m., just after discovering his parents' bodies, Virgil called the Fort Worth Police Department and reported what he'd found. When Detectives A.C. Howerton and Cody Rogers arrived, they immediately realized that what lay before them was one of the most vicious crimes they'd seen in their city. Detective Howerton, in fact, called it the most brutal murder he'd ever seen, and he was no spring chicken to the police force. He'd been on the job 27 years at that point. Still, he and Captain of Detectives O.R. Brown told reporters that the case was going to be tough to solve. Several detectives began poring through the ransacked home looking for clues, while others visited neighbors to see if anyone had witnessed anything unusual the previous night. Neighbors said they saw and heard nothing out of the ordinary. Even the tenants who lived in the above garage apartment on the Stanley's property, reported in the papers as Mr. and Mrs. Richard Taylor, heard nothing. The cops were sure the double murder took place as Hattie and Vernon Stanley prepared for bed. The couple slept in separate bedrooms, and it looked as though Hattie was responding to a commotion while Vernon was being attacked and was caught by the perpetrator in the hall. Because the air conditioning was turned down low, the house almost cold, the coroner remarked that the time of death was going to be difficult to determine. At first glance, it seemed obvious that the deaths of Vernon and Hattie Stanley were the result of a burglary gone wrong or a straight-up robbery, but as detectives poured through the contents of the ransacked home, the motive for the terrible crime became much less clear. Inside the Stanley home, in the kitchen, an electric coffee pot sat with coffee still inside. The slain couple's son, Virgil Stanley, told the police that that was unusual, as his mother Hattie never left anything sitting around like that. If she and Vernon were killed as they prepared for bed, the coffee pot would have most likely been cleaned. Hattie kept the home spotless, Virgil said. Cabinets in the kitchen, too, had been gone through by the intruder, the killer. In the living room of the home, the contents of drawers had been dumped on the floor. Among the items there was a brand new dress for a toddler, along with an empty gift box and blank card, likely a gift for Vernon and Hattie's 2-year-old grandchild, whose birthday was coming up. That find seemed heartbreaking, but hardly told a story about what might have been the motive to murder the elderly couple. But other things found were telling. In the bedroom where the bodies were discovered, which had also been ransacked, a bank book sat in the closet unhidden, and inside, $200 in cash remained untouched. In 1959, it's hard to imagine a burglar or robber missing out on that amount of cash. It was a pretty good chunk of change at the time, and considering the perpetrator had taken the time to go through virtually every nook and cranny in the home, the discovery of the $200 was strange. Vernon kept his wallet under his pillow when he slept, and that was found on the floor on the bedroom with no cash inside, and its contents dumped and scattered. Virgil commented that his father usually only carried a small amount of cash in that billfold, and added that he was certain the $200 found in the bank book had to have been the maximum amount of cash his parents would have kept in the home. If the slayings were a result of a burglary gone wrong or a robbery, the perpetrator too missed the two rings on Hattie's fingers that housed big diamonds. When the justice of the peace on the scene removed those rings from Hattie's body and placed them in Virgil's hands, he began sobbing again, inconsolably. Vernon and Hattie's other son, Bobby, got the news and took a plane out from his Air Force base the evening of the discovery of his parents' bodies. Even considering the valuables and cash that the intruder and murderer left behind, detectives were still considering the motive to be robbery. Because the house was so meticulously ransacked, Captain of Detectives O.R. Brown told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, they were theorizing that the perpetrator had a reason to believe that there was a large sum of cash somewhere in the house. Still, the cops' prediction that the case was going to be tough to crack was proving to be correct. They found nothing in the Stanley home that could be considered evidence, including the murder weapon, which police believed was an iron pipe. Even though they thought they had the motive figured out, Fort Worth detectives still pursued a few other things right off the bat. They questioned the air conditioner repairmen and the roofers who had been at the home earlier in the day the murders were thought to have taken place. But that was a dead end. Those guys were cleared. At Vernon's car lot, they pored over records to see if he'd had any vehicles repossessed recently, working through the possibility that someone wanted revenge on him for doing so. It's unclear whether detectives found anything with this line of investigation or not. But remember, Vernon was retired, and his son Virgil was handling the day-to-day at the car lot, so it seemed like a long shot anyway. Neighbors and friends of Hattie and Vernon were questioned. Two unnamed individuals whose relationship to the elderly couple wasn't disclosed were given polygraph tests, and women who were described as frightened housewives were calling into the Fort Worth Police Department worried that there was a madman on the loose. But Captain Brown relayed a message to everyone who was frightened that this could happen to them through the newspapers.
"We're still searching and digging for information. However, we have no definite indication that this crime was committed by a madman,"
Brown said on the Friday following the slayings.
"This was a vicious crime, but there is no reason to believe it will happen again. Well, no more than any other murder."
Also that Friday, June 12, 1959, funeral services were held for Vernon and Hattie Stanley at Fort Worth Baptist Church. They were laid to rest at Mount Olivet Cemetery. The following day, only hours after the elderly couple was lowered into their graves, a suspect emerged. At 1 a.m. on Saturday, June 13, 1959, an unnamed 39-year-old man, described only as a Fort Worth grocer, was arrested, caught in the act of burglarizing a home on the 1600 block of South Jennings Avenue in the city's South End. The intruder gained entrance into this home by slicing a screen on one of the windows. A similar method of entry, police believed, was used to break into the Stanleys' Oakhurst neighborhood home. At the Stanleys, in the back of the house, a screen had been removed from a window and placed on the ground beside it. The 39-year-old grocer, however, denied that he was burglarizing the home, and instead insisted that he was drunk and thought the house was his. He was held for suspicion of burglary, even after the cops determined that he was not responsible for the break-in at the Stanley home, let alone their slayings. As a rule, individuals closest to a murder victim, or in this case, victims, or those who stand to have the most to gain from a victim's death, are generally scrutinized first. The case of the murders of Vernon and Hattie Stanley are no different. The couple's sons, Virgil and Bobby, were beneficiaries of their estate, and they set to gain more than $10,000 each. It's an unfortunate ripple effect of a crime that had already traumatized Virgil and Bobby, but they had to be eliminated. Bobby, of course, was on base in Newfoundland at the time of his parents' slayings, but Virgil wasn't. And anyway, police had no other leads. The fact that Virgil was who discovered Hattie and Vernon's bodies, too, added to the suspicion of him. Also, unnamed individuals had called the Fort Worth Police Department reporting discord between Vernon and Virgil, father and son. His reaction to his parents' murders, though, was genuine, detectives thought. The guy was torn up, taking it hard. Captain of Detectives O.R. Brown and Detective A.C. Howerton commented that they'd been watching Virgil like a hawk, their words, and were convinced that he had no involvement. But still, this was a murder investigation, and every avenue had to be explored. On Tuesday, June 16th, nearly a week after he found his mother and father's savagely beaten bodies in their home, Virgil Stanley voluntarily submitted to a polygraph examination in Dallas. In fact, a detective commented, Virgil insisted that he take the exam. That was a stroke of luck for the detectives because they were loath to put Virgil through that. Anyway, he passed with flying colors. It crushed any inkling of suspicion the cops might have had. Again, Virgil was taking the death of his parents hard, and the cruelty of humanity only added to the man's trauma. Calls to his home asking Virgil and his wife why he killed his parents happened several times. The calls exacerbated his grief and sorrow. Detectives, they said, never truly doubted his innocence, and they were right back at square one, which was nowhere. On July 1st, 1959, it was announced that Tarrant County District Attorney Doug Crouch was putting up $100 of his own money to get a reward fund started. Crouch could taste how bad he wanted to put away the perpetrator or perpetrators of this horrible crime, and thought if he threw up some of his own money, others would too. He was right. Just a few days later, on July 4th, the reward fund had grown to $1,300, largely donated by Fort Worth car dealerships. Those dealerships asked not to be named, though, in fear that whoever killed the Stanleys would come after them in retaliation. That same day, it was announced that the Fort Worth police had stumbled upon their strongest suspect yet. The previous Thursday, July 2nd, 1959, an elderly woman was attacked in her southwest Fort Worth home, and like the Stanleys, she'd been beaten in the head by the perpetrator. 46-year-old Jimmy Perkins, a handyman by trade, broke into the home of 74-year-old widow Caroline Tack at 2110 Weatherby Street. Perkins, he told police, was out of work and desperate for money. He only sought to burglarize Mrs. Tack's home, he said. He'd worked for the widow before, off and on, for 15 years in fact, and when he'd approached her asking if she had anything for him to do earlier that day, Perkins told police, he saw a coin purse on her nightstand near the bedroom window. Mrs. Tack had no work for him, and he couldn't stop thinking about how broke he was, and that dang coin purse. He finally mulled over it enough that he decided to go back, break in, and get it. Perkins told police he panicked when Mrs. Tack woke up, subsequently stumbling over the foot of the bed, and that's when he whacked her. However it went down, luckily, the object Perkins used was only a 1x3 board that he'd brought, quote, just in case, and Caroline Tack received only minor injuries from the blows. Detective A.C. Howerton said that if Perkins had used a harder, heavier weapon, Mrs. Tack might have met the same fate as the Stanleys. Though Jimmy Perkins fully confessed to the attempted burglary and assault, he vehemently denied having anything at all to do with the murders of Vernon and Hattie Stanley. On Saturday, July 4th, 1959, Perkins was taken to Dallas to undergo a polygraph examination concerning the brutal slayings of the Stanleys, but it's completely unclear what became of him as a suspect. Mostly because another suspect, one the cops wanted bad, emerged less than 2 weeks later, a man named Liebert Everett Swaim. Late at night on Tuesday, July 14th, 1959, Fort Worth Police Patrolman K.J. Matthews and B.W. Anderson responded to a call made by a Riverside neighborhood woman. A strange man was lurking around her home on Bird Street. When the patrolmen arrived, they immediately noticed a man in the woman's yard attempting to hide behind a tree. He wore a paper sack over his head, I'm guessing with little eye holes cut out and everything. You can't make this shit up. Anyway, the man turned out to be 51-year-old retired United States Army Captain Liebert Everett Swaim. Swaim was wearing socks over his shoes, a little trick that would not only help disguise any footprints he left behind, but would also render his movements a little quieter once he successfully broke into a residence to burglarize it, or perhaps worse. On his person was a flashlight tied around his neck by a piece of leather strap, and several 3 to 4 feet lengths of trotline-type cord, each tied in nooses at one end. That's certainly unsettling. Swaim was detected right on time, since the house he was prowling around was the home of a woman who lived alone, and he'd later go on to face charges of sexual offenses, though they were a little different, which we'll get into a little later. The man was arrested for drunkenness and prowling and taken into custody. If the cops weren't already interested in questioning Swaim for the slayings of Hattie and Vernon Stanley immediately upon his arrest, which they likely were since detectives had also found the screen removed from the window of another nearby home that night, they most certainly became interested upon learning that he used to reside in the Oakhurst neighborhood, not far from the Stanley home. Quite close, in fact. Since the man was caught essentially red-handed prowling in Riverside, it wasn't difficult for detectives to get a warrant to search Swaim's property, all but instantly signed by a judge. The day following the arrest, July 15th, Fort Worth police detectives scoured Liebert Swaim's vehicle and home. In the glove compartment of his car, which was found right around the corner from where he was arrested, they found lineman pliers, which are made not only to grip, but also to cut wire. Gloves were in the compartment as well, and Detective Grady Hare told reporters that they had what looked like dried blood on them. Those, of course, were sent to a crime lab in Dallas to be analyzed right away. In the trunk of the car, a crowbar was found. In the man's home, police collected an illegal firearm, a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun, and what was described as several wooden cigar boxes filled with pills and hypodermic syringes. A homemade rope ladder was also taken for evidence, as were several surgical instruments, a hacksaw, and what was called narcotics paraphernalia. Swaim was a longtime Fort Worth resident and, in fact, was a longtime pharmacist at his own drugstore in West Texas before he closed up shop to serve in World War II. Since he'd been in Fort Worth after the war and a few years of service at Fort Sam Houston, he worked as a pharmacist again here and there and was still registered. But Liebert Swaim was a weird guy. Just a week before his arrest, when the manager of the apartment complex he lived in found him crouched behind a car in the parking lot and confronted him about it, Swaim took off running and fired a pistol at the man over his shoulder as he fled. He fired at least twice. The apartment manager quickly retrieved his gun and fired off a couple rounds just to try to scare him off. But that's not even the strangest little anecdote, detail, or event that surrounds the investigation into Liebert Ebert Swaim for the murders of Hattie and Vernon Stanley. Liebert Ebert Swaim, detectives said, was the best suspect they'd come across for the brutal bludgeoning murders of 65-year-old Hattie Stanley and her husband, 66-year-old Vernon Stanley. He was caught prowling a home in a neighborhood not far from the Stanley home, after all, and he'd once lived in that very neighborhood. In fact, he'd lived in a rented room on the same street as the slain couple, about a block away. He'd moved away from that area in January of 1959, 6 months before the Stanleys were killed. Gloves stained with a substance that resembled blood were also found in the man's car. Swaim's character and behavior, too, were strange and seemingly erratic. He was hardly what could be considered stable. Though Swaim tried to explain away the socks he was wearing over his shoes the night he was arrested for prowling as simply a way to prevent his dress shoes from getting dirty as he took a leisurely stroll, it's never mentioned how he attempted to explain away the paper bag the man was wearing over his head. That's a little harder, I suppose. As detectives began interrogating Swaim about the Stanley double murder, he remained steadfast in his claim that he had nothing to do with it, but kept going back and forth about his willingness to undergo a polygraph examination. While Swaim was figuring out whether or not he should submit to a lie detector test, detectives were speaking with several folks who had stories to tell about the man. Two individuals claimed to have seen Swaim on the Stanley's street, Bluebonnet Drive, a couple weeks before their murders, but the man vigorously denied visiting the neighborhood at all since he moved from the area the previous January. In the North Sylvania Avenue apartment complex where he lived, the cops found a woman who told them that on June 18, 1959, a man wearing a silk stocking over his head was attempting to climb through her bedroom window. She screamed, and the man fled. It's unclear if the woman identified Liebert Swaim as this would-be intruder. Meanwhile, at a Texas Department of Public Safety lab in Dallas, police chemist George Brown said upon a visual examination of the gloves found in Swaim's car, the substance on them indeed appeared to be blood. Brown told a reporter for an article published on July 17th that he couldn't say for sure, though. The press would have to wait for the test results to come back, just like the cops. That same day, it was announced that Swaim had decided to take the polygraph test, but the results had come back inconclusive. Fort Worth Police Detective Grady Hare did say, however, that the machine showed no reaction when Swaim denied having any knowledge about the murders of Vernon and Hattie Stanley, meaning, of course, that the machine indicated that he was telling the truth. Another examination was scheduled. Swaim, though, refused to take another one. Regardless of the fact that the polygraph machine showed he was telling the truth when asked the big question, other circumstances seemed to solidify suspicions that Swaim was responsible for the murders. On the morning after they were killed, the morning the bodies of Hattie and Vernon were found by their 39-year-old son Virgil, Swaim hopped in the car with his adult daughter and headed almost 200 miles northwest of Fort Worth to Crowell, Texas. He spent a week there at his mother's house, apparently not leaving once. That certainly didn't look good. It looked like a hiding out till the heat dies down kind of thing. On Saturday, July 19th, detectives took Liebert Swaim back up to Crowell in hopes they'd discover some type of evidence against him, but they did not. Detective Hare added that he would file federal charges against Swaim for his possession of the sawed-off shotgun found in his apartment during the execution of the search warrant. The drugs, too, were being sent to labs in Austin, and the police commented that they planned to file narcotics charges when the results came back. The shotgun and hacksaw collected from the man's home were also sent off to the crime lab in search of trace bloodstains. On Monday, July 20th, 1959, authorities placed Swaim in the county jail's mental patient facility at John Peter Smith Hospital upon a judge's order. This was pending transfer to a state mental health facility after his 19-year-old daughter signed a complaint requesting he be committed for a 90-day treatment. Though his daughter's official complaint was lunacy, county doctors insisted that Liebert Swaim was not mentally ill, but instead needed treatment for drug addiction. By July 24th, when Swaim was to be admitted to the Wichita Falls State Hospital, he was fine with it. He voluntarily checked in with no issue, likely just to get away from Fort Worth detectives. He refused, however, to sign for the treatment of narcotics addiction, insisting that no such treatment was necessary. He wasn't on drugs, Swaim said. Finally, it was reported on August 7th that the substance found on the gloves collected from Swaim's vehicle was indeed human blood. It was then also reported that a mattress cover collected from the man's apartment also had human blood stains. A blood type from those stains on both items, however, was unable to be determined. The only way at the time to find out if the blood could have belonged to the Stanleys. It wasn't a 99% way to prove guilt, like DNA often is today, but more of a probability thing, another piece of circumstantial evidence. Meanwhile, up in Wichita Falls, doctors couldn't figure out what to think about Liebert Everett Swaim. They wanted badly to call it schizophrenia, but ultimately they couldn't. I could go on and on here about what happens next, the newspaper reports certainly do, but instead I'll attempt to make a long, redundant story short. The entire time since his arrest in mid-July, Swaim had been attempting to get bail set, but the motion was continually denied. In fact, Swaim's attorney had been attempting to get his client out of jail since a week after the arrest on the grounds that he was being held without formal charges against him. Liebert Swaim's admittance to a mental health facility was, in essence, the police response to the demands for his release. It allowed him to continue being detained, at least in some capacity. When committed to the state hospital, Swaim repeatedly tried to get out, but couldn't. Every time his release date was coming up, the state doctors filed another complaint against him, keeping him there just a little longer each time. Finally, though, not long after he was admitted to Wichita Falls State Hospital, Swaim's defense had arranged back in Fort Worth for bail to be set, but he had to be released from the state hospital and sent back to jail before it could be officially set and subsequently posted. He almost got his release from Wichita Falls facility after one of the complaints against him was set to expire, but the cops quickly slapped him with a narcotics charge to ensure that when he was released from the hospital, he'd be heading straight back to a Tarrant County jailhouse, back to some type of charges. Authorities back in Fort Worth had been trying desperately to work up a case against Swaim in the murders of Hattie and Vernon Stanley, but they simply couldn't come up with any evidence, really, to bring forth charges, much less an indictment from a grand jury. When Swaim got back to lockup in Tarrant County, a judge set his bail at $10,000. On Thursday, August 13, 1959, a grand jury reviewed the narcotics charges against Liebert Everett Swaim. District Attorney Doug Crouch commented that the chances that charges would stick looked good. At a hearing the following day, Swaim's bond was reduced to $7,500 after his defense attorney threatened to take the case before the Criminal Court of Appeals. Swaim, defense attorney Doss Harden said, hadn't taken narcotics for over 2 years, and county doctor Harold Schilling told the court that the man was not a heavy drug user. Swaim only occasionally popped barbiturates and dexedrine, you know, the stuff that Elvis was taking when he was in Germany in the army, not the opiate-based intravenous narcotics that the district attorney was claiming. A week later, on Thursday, August 20th, things looked bad and embarrassing for Fort Worth police and District Attorney Crouch when some results of the testing of the supposed narcotics collected as evidence from Swaim's home came back. One of the drugs found there was shown to be Ipecac, a vomit-inducing pill that is most often given to kids who'd swallowed a dangerous substance. The drug doesn't mess you up, aside from its intended purpose, isn't habit-forming, and in fact, you could get it over-the-counter. As far as the narcotics paraphernalia charge, well, Swaim seemed to be exempt from that, since he was a registered pharmacist, and it wasn't necessarily illegal for him to be in possession of things like hypodermic needles. Though the results of the testing of the other pills found in Swaim's apartment were still ongoing, the Ipecac charge, of course, was dropped. It was a huge embarrassment to the DA and the cops. Swaim was never brought back up on charges for those drugs, no matter how bad the DA and police wanted him locked up, so they likely proved to be nothing. The railroading of Liebert Everett Swaim for the slayings of Vernon and Hattie Stanley was over as quick as it came. In fact, the deaths of Vernon and Hattie Stanley were virtually written out of history. No more press until like 8 months later, and pretty much nothing after that. It's likely Swaim being held without official charges, being sent to a state hospital, and the court's refusal to set bond played a part in his son's decision to become a bail bondsman and private investigator. His son, John Winter Swaim, would go on to be possibly the most productive investigator, even more so than the Fort Worth police, on the case of the December 1974 disappearances of Rachel Trelisa, Renee Wilson, and Julie Mosley. But I suppose that's neither here nor there. Now, I'm not saying Swaim didn't kill Hattie and Vernon. I don't know. The cops sure made it seem certain, but then again, when it all ended, they had nothing. They had no evidence. The Fort Worth police spent so much time and energy on Swaim that they potentially lost time and focus concentrating on him. But there's no reason to cry a river for the injustices against Liebert Everett Swaim, and I don't want to come across like I am. He was a sick creep. In 1965, Swaim was arrested for driving drunk and carrying a prohibited weapon, the charges of which ended up being dropped. He'd be charged again years later for carrying another prohibited weapon. A charge the previous year, 1964, however, was much more concerning. In Abilene, Swaim went on trial for fondling a 9-year-old girl. The fondling took place on February 13th of that year at Swaim's home, and the following day, Swaim went to the girl's house to give her a box of Valentine's candy. Ugh. The girl had already told her father about what had happened, and he chased Swaim away, firing his pistol in the air twice. At his July 1964 trial, Swaim had the best lawyers in the area, it seems, two ex-Taylor County prosecutors, Bill Thomas and Alan Glenn. Alan Glenn, in fact, was a former judge as well. If you had a DWI, these guys were going to get you off. Hell, if you molested a child or committed murder, they were going to get you off. In 1962, they got Airman T.R. McCrane acquitted of the charges of molesting his sergeant's 8-year-old daughter. In 1966, Thomas and Glenn got a sentence of 5 years probation for their client Paul Neeb, who shot to death his estranged wife's live-in boyfriend at their home when he went to try and reconcile with her. Imagine that, a 5-year probation for a fragile man's ego blow that resulted in straight-up murder. These guys were good, or were at least connected. But it gets crazier than that. Thomas and Glenn also went on to represent Josephine Marie Marks of Baird, Texas, in 1976. Marks beat to death her adopted daughter, who was 2.5 years old. Thomas and Glenn argued that it wasn't the beating that killed the little girl, but a previous injury that occurred when she collided with her adopted brother as they played. The beating, Thomas and Alan said, only kicked that previous injury into high gear, killing the child. It was utter nonsense, but apparently the jury was made up of 12 complete morons who ate it right up. Anyway, they found Marks guilty of involuntary manslaughter, sure. The lowest charge offered, but the sentence of 10 years probation reflected the success of the defense. So, back to Liebert Swaim's trial for molesting a 9-year-old girl. Even though Swaim, who was 54 years old at the time, visited the girl's home to bring her Valentine's candy the day following the offense, which clearly shows a great and depraved perversion, Thomas and Glenn got him off. Swaim simply lost his balance as he fell and accidentally felt up the little girl, they said. He was found not guilty by a Taylor County jury. The following year, Swaim was arrested for fondling a little girl again. It's unclear what became of that charge. Among plenty of other trouble with the law, Liebert Swaim was charged in 1966 with indecent exposure, apparently exposing his genitals to 2 5-year-old boys at an Abilene parking lot at Mockingbird Lane and North 3rd Street. The grand jury declined to indict in that offense. Perhaps it will never be known who brutally bludgeoned to death Hattie and Vernon Stanley, or the motive behind the attack, what the perpetrator was looking for. Liebert Everett Swaim, the Fort Worth police's only real suspect, died in 1985. In June of 1960, a year after his parents were savagely slain, Virgil told reporters that some members of his family were terrified and went into hiding after the murders, fearing perhaps that the perpetrator of the crime held some sort of grudge against the entire Stanley clan and was seeking revenge. Either way, both Hattie and Vernon's sons went to their graves not knowing who killed their parents. And why? Virgil Stanley died in 1975 at age 55, essentially of alcoholism. Bobby Stanley passed away in 1993 at age 60. All the Stanleys, including Virgil's twin brother, Vernon Jr., who died at age 3, and Hattie and Vernon's premature baby girl, who only lived one day, are buried together at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Fort Worth. If you have any information about the 1959 murders of Vernon and Hattie Stanley, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or help identify a Jane or John Doe, there's a way you can do that. Please go to DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. We'll provide a link in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the episode Fort Worth 1974 and the Riverside Village Massacre. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. It means the world to us, and we couldn't do this without you. WBAP-TV NBC News Scripts, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Abilene Reporter News, and the Stanley Family Tree were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.